Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Larimer, and today I'm joined by Mr. Terence Corrigan. Terence, how are you doing, sir?
Well, aside from the fact that I have no light, I'm okay.
That's always good to hear. And of course, Mr. Chris Hutton. Chris, how are you doing?
Hi, Nick. Doing well, thanks. I thought I heard something. I didn't see Terence, but I heard his voice coming from somewhere above me. So I'll just keep on pretending that he's here with us.
Very good. Just a quick note to those of you watching us on YouTube, please give us a comment about we're trying a slightly different format for the video screen. Just tell us what you think of it, whether you think it's better or worse than the more spaced out version. That's the more spaced out version. This is the version we're trying today. So let me know what you think. All right. With that out of the way, let's get into the news. One of the more interesting and amusing stories in South Africa's wacky world of corruption and dysfunction is the story coming out of the Daily Maverick yesterday that the South African tourism industry is looking at a new way to promote the country, following in the footsteps of wealthy oil barons and authoritarian rulers like Rwanda. South Africa is looking at perhaps buying advertising space with a UK Premier League soccer team. So according to documents that the Daily Maverick says that it obtained, the South African government, through its marketing agency SA Tourism, is preparing to sign a deal worth 910 million rand, so just under a billion rand, to sponsor one of the English Premier League's best loan teams, Tottenham Hotspur. In some documents that they received, there was a presentation given to SA Tourism on the 27th of January about this. And apparently the discussions are still underway as to whether to ink it. The idea, I think, is to have a advert for the South African tourism on the sleeve of the soccer team. This would follow in the footsteps of Rwanda, who has, I think, I can't remember which football club it is with, but they have a sleeve advert that says Visit Rwanda. And it would be a three-year deal, so about a billion rand for 3 years. As it's also intended, apparently, to announce this during Ramaphosa's State of the Nation address, some sort of big win for the South African tourism industry. Tottenham Hotspur is the eighth most valuable football club brand globally, according to some analysis of the team. And in the presentation, which the Daily Maverick says it has seen, it's very clearly stated that the part of the emphasis for this is that South Africa will lose out to these other countries like the UAE or Rwanda if it doesn't seize this opportunity to sign this great deal. There's also an accusation that Lindiwe Sisulu, the tourism minister, is trying to push this through before she gets reshuffled into a different part of the government, because there's a long-expected reshuffle of Ramaphosa's government, which seems to be in the news endlessly, but he's taking his sweet time in actually doing it. A charge which he has very aggressively rejected, saying in a response to the Daily Maverick's reporting that this article is riddled with inaccuracies and untruths aimed at tarnishing Minister Sisulu's image. There is no doubt the report seeks to drive a political agenda rather than inform the public truthfully in line with journalism ethos. The reporter falsely claims that Minister Sisulu is forcing SA Tourism to push the deal through before she has moved from the tourism portfolio. This is a blatant lie. Right. So, Chris, let me start with you. I mean, on one hand, this sounds kind of expensive and kind of like a waste of money. But on the other hand, I don't know. The English Premier League is watched by an enormous number of people around the world. It's certainly a very visible platform. Is there any merit to this, do you think?
I don't have the stats readily available, but don't British tourists compose a large part of South Africa's tourism base in any case? So
I think they're
already very exposed to South Africa. I mean, in classic South African government fashion, they couldn't have picked one of the more unreliable teams in the Premier League. I mean, Spurs, they're probably going to get this deal close to finishing, and then Spurs are going to pull out or let them down, as they tend to do in the competitions, and their fans can tell you. They don't do as well as they promise when the campaign starts. So another note for South Africa there, for the government giving them a vote of confidence. I do think, look, if you're going to try and get more tourists to your country, there are better things that you can try and do. For example, ensuring that the lights don't go out for about 16 hours, however many hours a day. Making sure that potholes on average get fixed much faster than some of them get fixed now, reliable water services, all that sort of stuff. I think that's sort of low-hanging fruit. Now, then you can argue this is the Department of Tourism's job. They should be focusing on attracting tourists. I think they should be focused more on using the resources that they do have to try and support those businesses that were that experienced harsh lockdowns, that couldn't have guests coming over the last 3 or 4 years. All that sort of stuff. Maybe focus on small business support instead of these grand billboard sponsorship campaigns. I didn't really see that you're going to get a lot of bang for your buck in terms of economic efficiency. If you want to take the merits of the argument, for example, if you're going to spend this kind of money, maybe spend it on more basic issues in terms of getting that right. Maybe upgrading your licensing systems for people with bed and breakfast and those sort of things you need to register with the government. Are those systems as up to date and in place as they should be, as they could be? Maybe you focus on those things first before you try and do all this glitzy sort of stuff. And then also just the point on making sure that we now can compete with countries like the UAE, etc. I mean, they're already doing a very good case selling their locations for tourism. So South Africa could just get the basics right and would already then boost its own tourism numbers, I think.
So it is worth mentioning as well that in the same Daily Maverick report, they talked to some tourism analysts or experts. I don't know what a tourism expert necessarily is, but anyway, who said that the marketing value that was claimed would be gained from this deal was absolutely ludicrous, and that similar projects have been proposed all the way back since 2017 and were always rejected because of how absolutely lack, as you say, lack of kind of bang for your buck here. Terence, obviously there are things that a tourism industry minister can do to make it easier to succeed in our tourism industry here. But I think ultimately we're really not going to see the great potential in our tourism industry until crime is a little bit more under control. What are your thoughts?
It's a whole bunch of things, you know. Look, I must confess to being the ultimate couch potato. So, you know, Tottenham Hotspur's record or lack thereof, you know, is really somewhere in my head. But yeah, you know, it's about whether people have positive experiences, whether you get value for money. You know, different countries with tourism industries have different offerings. Before Greece went onto the euro, it was known as, you know, a nice cheap Mediterranean destination, mostly for Europeans, but Americans, actually, so South Africans, I remember in the 1980s, also used to go there because, you know, for what you got, you know, the rand traveled quite well to that destination. If you are if you're a tourist going to the UK or Sweden or whatever, you're going for a very different reason. Now people come to South Africa, a European, American, you know, say well-heeled tourists. They come for the wildlife, for the open spaces, for you know, the kind of sun and sand holiday, for cheap food, you know, lots of meat and beer and whatever, you know, braaivleis and brandewijn, and you know that, and so, you know, that's kind of what South Africa's offering is. And to bring those people in, yes, security, very important. I think that's possibly South Africa's single biggest liability. You probably find 95-96% of visitors to South Africa are trouble-free. But it's always the one, you know, where I remember there was a Polish tourist who got raped. I can just imagine the shockwaves that sends through the sending market. Electricity, you know, come to South Africa, just bring your own generator. You know, if you have issues with your beaches not being so, you know, sprightly, sparkly, clean, you could. You know, there are plenty of alternatives. You know, if you want the sort of South African experience, the outdoorsy wildlife, sun and sand, you know, Australia offers a very similar package. places like Thailand, Malaysia, Brazil. Brazil's also got the got the crime issue. But yeah, you know, that it's farcical to think that you know, by associating South Africa's brand, particularly as Chris says, in a market where South Africa is already well known, with a football team, it's going to pay massive dividends. Yeah, I'll tell you something else. Because of family and personal and business connections, prospective British tourists to South Africa are going to know, you know, a lot more about the goings on in South Africa, about the fact that, you know, you show up in Joburg and you sit in traffic for 10 hours because the lights don't work, and then you go back to your hotel and the power's not on, and there are just things that are, you know, unnecessarily complicated. The other interesting thing is that, and I don't know if anyone's pointed this out, but Tottenham Hotspurs has an identity very much bound up with the Jewish community and also with Israel. So I don't know, could we see Visit South Africa alongside the Star of David or something?
So here's a very cynical take on why there might be incentives for some in government to do this kind of thing. If you're an out-of-touch political elite who likes to hand out patronage, a deal like this is probably going to be really great for your personal enjoyment, because I suspect that it'll come with lots of free tickets, meeting famous football stars a little bit here and there, sipping champagne in London while you watch the game from the box in a stadium. And one really does have to wonder, considering the, you know, shocking levels of corruption in the state, whether this is a driving factor here, is that this is really, in a sense, just the kind of political elite's attempt to get themselves some free luxury holidays. Any final thoughts, Chris?
Just you mentioned the other team that's got Visit Rwanda, so that's Arsenal. So, I mean, maybe this is a way to drum up some interest and some rivalry between the two North London clubs. I don't know, for South Africa to sponsor one, Rwanda sponsor the other one. And maybe South Africa, I'm actually surprised they haven't used this as a justification that they want to then use it for sports development in South Africa and help our own soccer players, because they need all the help they can get. But maybe I shouldn't give them ideas.
Indeed. All right, let's move on to our next story of the day. And this is stuff that's going on with regards to Eskom. Unfortunately, I thought about putting this as the first story today, but I just honestly can't deal with dealing as the first story with Eskom every single day this week. So there is some news, rather, from Mpumalanga with regards to alternative power sources that are not run by Eskom. In this case, there's a company called Sereti Resources, which says the first phase of what it says is going to be South Africa's largest wind farm, when it's fully completed, will come online in 2025. This wind farm is going to be built near, I think, Tutuka Power Station in Mpumalanga, in that like quite grim part of Mpumalanga that you have to drive through to get to the nice holiday bits in the Far East.
Yeah, tourism.
The first phase, indeed. The first phase of the project, they say they can finish by 2025, which will add 150 megawatts to the grid. And I think the total goal is to have something like 900 megawatts when the whole project is completed. Now, that is definitely good, but there are some issues. It's worth pointing out that even some of the smaller coal power plants produce 1,000 megawatts in of themselves. And our biggest ones are supposed to have, I think, 3,000. I think Medupi and Kusile both have like 3,500 megawatts potential power. So there is, I think, some questions about, firstly, whether the project will be provide as much power as it says it will. But even if it does, I don't know. Terence, let me get your thoughts on this. You know, here we finally seem to be having a private company producing power that will be fed back into the grid. It's not going to take super long. You know, 2 years and the timescale of these projects is not really that much. But it just doesn't seem like it's going to be quite enough to fix some of the shortfalls. I wonder if in 2 years, the deficit from Eskom is going to be even worse in terms of power. What's your take on the story?
look, okay. I think that one has to see this for what it is. It's a privately run renewable power power project that is that's going to produce, you know, x amount of power. This is not a solution to South Africa's power crisis. For that, we actually need Eskom big power stations, whatever, to work. We need to get, you know, larger scale investment in. But I suspect that what you're seeing here is the kind of smallish, more localized solution, or, you know, at least some refraction of it, that is going to become increasingly necessary given the overall malaise that the country is stuck in. So, yeah, you know, while I don't think we should celebrate this as any kind of silver bullet, I think rather see it as a guide dog to what is likely to take off. You know, the phrase state proofing. Now, maybe this is Cerruti's plan. Maybe it's not. Maybe they wouldn't like to be associated with it. But I think fundamentally, this is what that looks like.
So, Chris, I'm going to ask you, firstly, do you have any thoughts to add to what Terence has said? And secondly, I just want you to tell us about the letter that you had published in, I think it's the Business Day recently, with regards to another topic we've been talking about the whole week related to this, the state of disaster, which it looks like the ANC is heading for declaring with regards to Eskom.
Yeah, on the specific project, I mean, I think Terence is absolutely correct to highlight that no one is trying to sell this or promote it as a solution to all the problems that the country faces in terms of electricity. But we're faced now with the compounding crises of a failing Eskom and a failing state. And then we keep on saying people, private businesses are going to fill the void, private investment. And this is the sort of form that takes. So whether it's going to be efficient or not, et cetera, we'll see how it shakes out and what issues they face. Maybe others can learn from it. So I do think hopefully it's a good step in a small step in the right direction. I don't think we should expect sea change overnight. We should expect maybe small things like this to hopefully at some point have a cumulatively good effect. Also, you have issues around dispatchable energy, battery storage, all that sort of stuff. So this shouldn't be seen as an overnight solution, but hopefully the sort of thing that more and more people are going to try and do within the limited resources that they have to try and stay proof themselves as best as possible, themselves, their businesses, their communities, etc. And then just on that letter, so around the state of disaster, I try to highlight just that I don't think it's a solution really for the operational systems and corruption issues that Eskom and the broader state faces. So you can impose a state of disaster, you can give ministers more power, etc., etc. But then I think the risk is that that leads to potentially more abuse by the state of citizens and businesses, as we saw with the COVID-19 lockdowns, and that's that a disaster. You had the National Coronavirus Command Council. You might have something similar now with electricity. Would the Electricity Command Council also be led by Minister Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma? What sort of irrational regulations might be announced or imposed? For example, saying when you may use your stove or not, when you may go to a shopping center or not, what forms of power you may use or what you may not. So I think it's exactly the same people who are still in charge of the state now that were over the last 3 or 4 years and before then. And the amount of power that they've had has unfortunately led to more abuse of civil liberties and the constitution versus not. So I don't see why that would be different this time around. And I don't think it fixes any of the fundamental problems at Eskom. I mean, the regulations, things like preferential procurement, BEE, localization requirements, all of that stuff, ministers can already suspend those. They can cut through those. That's within their remit right now. They don't need a state of disaster for that. So, and again, another potential avenue for looting, so that you make sure that you promulgate regulations that those with the necessary political connections can take most advantage of. So they'll benefit from that while not really solving any issues that plague the electricity market as a whole.
Terence, your thoughts on the state of disaster?
Well, yeah, I think we better get used to raw chicken then. No, it's what What I believe happened here is that there was a certain taste for that control society developed when it was locked down for COVID. So this is kind of like an intellectual running home to mommy, you know. Oh, you know, let's we have a disaster. Let's declare a state of disaster. Exactly what that gets you is in practical terms, I don't understand. If it's about regulations or whatever, well, you know, then don't impose so many. You know, don't sit on bid windows for years and years and years. And you know, this is a long term issue. What I suspect may be happening, if the you know, if I could if I can suggest, you know, something in the realm of a plausible rational explanation, is that if you can short circuit procurement. You know, give more discretion to policymakers. The idea may be that for the next sort of year and a half, you know, conveniently sort of coming up to the election, they're able to make sure that we never run out of diesel, for instance, so that, you know, for that period, we can just, you know, run the turbines until they break. And after that, well, you've got 5 years to try and repair the damage. But aside from that, I think that this is entirely performative. It's, you know, about saying, you know, we feel your pain, and as I've said in the show previously, Bill Clinton's already felt our pain. You can't better that.
Yeah, no, this all just stinks of a kind of unpleasant cynicism that really, yeah, not something I'm particularly fond of. Anyway, hopefully it doesn't happen. We'll keep pushing against it on what public platforms we have. all right, let's move on to our next story. And this one's not immediately obvious, but Terence, you did write an opinion piece on it, which is, I think, worth discussing. So in Cape Town, there has recently been this really horrible murder. There was a 13-year-old boy whose body parts were found, I think, in the drain of a 56-year-old man. And the allegations initially coming out here is that this man killed this boy for stealing mangoes, I think, from his property. But it's also possible there was some other very strange component to all of this, which is that a lawyer representing the accused has claimed that this is all to do with some kind of fascination with the occult, and what might be called, I think, in tabloid press, a satanic murder, that was the real motivation behind here. Terence, you wrote an opinion piece about this story and how we should look at something, you know, sort of so horrifying as this. Mm. What's your take?
Okay, look, the reason why this has popped up into the news cycle today is that remains of the child were found in a have now been confirmed to have belonged to the child who was missing. This happened about a year ago. My caution about this is that there was an instant jumping on a kind of moral panic bandwagon around the word farmer, that this was another case of, you know, the abusive white farmer, you know, callously murdering a defenseless child, and that was just incorrect. This guy was not a farmer. He did not live on a farm. Whether this was malicious or simply incompetent, it seems to have sprung from the claim that the child was accosted while he was stealing mangoes from a fruit tree. Now, a mango tree in your backyard does not a farmer make. But you know, these things are, as you guys know, my work has had a lot to do with agriculture and the farming economy, and this is to make that sort of invocation is often to sort of scratch something ideological. Now, on the facts of the case, this is well, at least what we know so far. This does seem to have, you know, all sorts of sordid twists and turns. And yes, indeed, the guy, the accused lawyer has claimed that he was involved with a cult, and this was a case of human sacrifice. My concern about all of that is that these sort of claims arise periodically. Now, I grew up in the 1980s, where South Africa was a very unstable place. Well, I mean, it was sort of like it was an unstable society, but you know, if you were sort of white and middle class, you kind of lived in a bubble, and your world was fairly stable, but you could see everything going crazy around you. And we used to have these periodic satanic panics, and you know, sometimes the discourse around them was almost comic. I remember there was a story in the local newspaper that there had not been a satanic sacrifice on this particular night, you know, which was apparently some sort of, you know, night that Satanists did their sacrifices on. Not that there'd ever been one before, and this sort of thing was taken very, very seriously. I think that it's a, you know, on the one hand, this is this speaks to something in the South African psyche, a very kind of melodramatic, apocalyptic frame of mind, you know, whether it's the devil or, you know, whoever else. But I think it also speaks to a society under enormous stress, where you cannot predict the future, and you start to look for scapegoats and symbolism that can, you know, show that you are just that, you know, things are just, you know, so far beyond your control, there really is nothing you can do about it. And yes, I remember the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Pokemon. The big thing when I was growing up was that apparently you could play Madonna backwards and you'd get I never quite understood why it was that it was always about, you know, invoking you to worship the Prince of Darkness, not to buy more records, but apparently that's what commercial music was all about. But no, look, you know, the thing is what happened to this child was dreadful. This was a real person who was murdered and dismembered. We need to have the facts in before rendering any kind of judgment.
Exactly. And I must say that the kind of moral panics you described, they're really, you know, I agree, they're definitely some part of societies that are under a lot of stress. And I also think they kind of give people this, you know, when people believe that there is an enemy kind of hidden amongst us in plain sight, there's a very common theme to human politics. You can find an analog for it in every single society that's ever existed where something like this has come up. And I think one of the reasons for it is that it really does give people a sort of false sense of control, which is that if we just destroy the enemy amongst us, everything will be okay, which is of course never true, because nothing will ever, the world will never be completely okay because we don't live in a utopia. Chris, any thoughts to add on this before you close up?
No, just to reinforce your last point, and of course, who amongst us is enlightened or powerful enough, or who should we trust enough to then fight that enemy and kill that enemy? And what do you then surrender in the process? I think that's it's a very alluring and dangerous sort of idea, but I think it feeds into a lot of things we see around people's relationship with the state and with business and all that sort of stuff. So I think important to highlight this kind of thing.
No, definitely. And I saw someone suggesting in the comments that maybe the reason that Satanism has been brought up in the case of this murder as some kind of insanity defense. And as far as I understand, according to the reporting, the accused is currently undergoing psychiatric evaluation. So maybe that is what they're going for here. But regardless, I think Terence's thoughts on the way these things can get out of control is worth considering. Okay. Go ahead, Terence.
One last thing about that wind farm. I don't know why they didn't put it in the garden outside the cabinet room.
All that hot air. Okay, let us close up for today and for the week. We'll see you all next week, and we hope that you have a great weekend. Cheers, everyone.